So if we just start, have you say your name and your institutional affiliation?
Mm-hmm. I'm Sandra Harding, and I'm retired from the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA.
And when did you first recognize yourself as a scholar of science and technology?
Well, I was trained to be a good analytic philosopher, a philosopher of science and an epistemologist. But the minute I went out of grad school, got my doctorate, I went rogue. And my teaching experiences, even though I'm trained as an analytic philosopher, I have always held a joint appointment in a social science department for 41 years. I think there was 1 year when I didn't. So for me, as a philosopher of social science, for example, I get to live in my laboratory, and I get to watch my colleagues and my graduate students struggle with incomplete data sets, with interviews that miss the important question, with surveys that don't add up to what they want them to, and the struggle they have to make facts out of these data that they collect are just wonderful for me to watch. So I taught first briefly in an experimental social science college, and that this would have been in 1966, 67, something like that, at SUNY Albany, the Allen Center. So I had sitting in on my classes physicists, economists, sociologists, and when I taught my well-prepared analytic philosophy of science, they took me aside and they said, "Sandra, you're not going to pollute these fresh minds with that, are you?" And I had to rethink what I was doing. I had no idea that that was a bad thing to do. Then I moved to the University of Delaware, which was a big science campus because of DuPont, primarily, in 1976. And I, within a year or two, I had a joint appointment in the graduate department in sociology. And I also taught African American studies, African American philosophy, when there was one book available to use for it. And now for the last 25 years or so, until I retired in 2014, I taught in the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. There are 51 line faculty in the department, me and one other philosopher, and 49 social scientists. And they have 700 graduate students. That's a lot. So I was always working with graduate students who were collecting data. They were social scientists. And so this is to say that coming to the science in society part of this has been with me from the very, you know, early days of before Kuhn was Kuhn. It was way back there.
How did you find your way into a social science joint appointment in the first place?
That's another story. So as one of the four or five people who developed standpoint theory, feminist standpoint theory, most of the others were social scientists. Dorothy Smith and Patricia Hill Collins were sociologists, are sociologists. Nancy Hartsock is a political scientist. And we would, in the early days, one of us, we knew each other's work. I mean, it was a tiny little group of people working. And one of us would capture a position on an association program, the History of Science or AAAS or something, and invite the others. And we'd have a panel and talk about objectivity. And it, in retrospect, it was like watching two-year-old play. We would sit and look at each other and then do our own thing. And we didn't know how to put it together in the kinds of ways we subsequently developed. So This is to say that in my own work, I've worked with social scientists all the way through. And what I initially referred to as standpoint epistemology, in the last decade or more, I've come to call standpoint methodology, because that works better in the practical social sciences. So that's the best I can say for that. It's just always been part of my life, both institutionally. My students have been coming from the social sciences, and also in my own personal scholarly work. I can tell you, though, that I've been told this story several times by several people. When in the sociology department, people say, "What is it that Sandra Harding's doing in your department?" And they say, "We have no idea, it must be philosophy." When the same question is asked in philosophy, they give the same answer. "We have no idea, it must be sociology." So I think standpoint theory is one of a number of social theories that have brought together, have made huge changes in research thinking that have consequences for several disciplines. So sociology of knowledge, Hilary Rose is another person who was involved, and she's always been a sociologist of science in particular. So I don't know how to answer that question except to say that I went rogue when I got out of graduate school.
And so you were developing a methodology. How did it touch down with science? Like, where did those two worlds come together?
Well, I'm going to talk about that later when I talk about the practical implications of SDS. But let me give the short answer to it now. I think there are two areas that have been and remain crucial. One is public education. We're all educators. And bringing STS issues into general education, not only as a specialty for scholars, but training the next generations how to think about science and technology in the kinds of ways that literary criticism teaches people how to think about poetry and novels and so forth. Art criticism does the same. But there's been, STS is as close as it gets in the sciences and technology. And of course, the word criticism scares the scientists, precisely because they don't think of their work as social, having any social context. But I think the need for that becomes especially clear right now in the wild and awful political context of the U.S., but also other countries, where issues about what counts as truth are on the front page of the paper every day. And when it gets to science and technology, some people treat them just as if they're people's individual preferences, and as if there's no rational reasons for holding them with the kind of respect and the kind of understanding that STS brings to the project. So I think just on this issue alone, this answer to the question alone, many scientists are very happy with STS work and the kind of work that I do. I mean, physicists don't tend not to understand it, but biologists sure do. Anybody working in the medical area does. Environmentalists do. So I think the natural sciences are as diverse as any other field. And that's before we get to the social sciences, which are supposed to be doing this, but don't always do it.
Great.
I'm going to cough. I'm gonna take a drink of water.
So now we'll do number three.
Okay.
Which text was most important to your early understanding of what STS is?
Well, I'm going to pick Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions because it just has been so important in my history here. So when I was being trained as a good analytic philosopher, my absolutely favorite, very adored philosophy of science professor had been a student of Carnap's. And so Carnap was part of the Vienna Circle, the group in Germany and Austria that in the late 30s and early 40s fled Europe, and many of them ended up in the U.S., and indeed Carnap's office was at UCLA. I was in his office for a while. That's another wonderful story. I'd walk in the door, and that's where he'd been. And so my professor just loved Carnap. And we had a moment of silence every October or whenever it was to commemorate Carnap's birthday. This is my first course in college, in grad school. I thought, wow, this is kind of a club or something. This is pretty fancy. But meanwhile, Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions came out in 62. I went back to grad school in 67 in sociology for a year before I got myself over to philosophy the following year. And I read The Structure of Scientific Revolutions in some kind of social theory course. I forget what it was. So Kuhn was being treated as a sociologist at that point, which is what, where many people have commented, he made his greatest contributions in a way. So when the next year I got into, I went to grad school in philosophy, switched to philosophy, and wanted to ask questions about Kuhn from this favored professor. No way. He said this was ephemera, it would disappear, and he was not going to entertain any questions on it in the class. So, of course, several of us graduate students said, wow, let's have a Kuhn reading group. This is pretty exciting to have somebody that this guy feels so strongly against. So we did, and we talked about it. And from there, I went on my own, not with the help of the philosophy department, that's for sure. And probably a few years later, I can't quite date this, to read David Bloor and Barry Barnes, and I followed the Kuhn disputes, Feyerabend, and so forth. So the rest is history. I mean, I got into it. Kuhn was really important in that.
I love that you willed it not to be ephemeral.
Right.
You created yourself.
Yes, we did. Yes, it was. He was at a particular moment, and I'm currently writing a paper for a collection on that's trying to bring Feyerabend into the present moment. He's kind of been neglected in that history. And both of them had a kind of, what's the word, a spirit of the era they lived in. I mean, this was the 60s, right? And revolution was in the air. And you can find those kind of reflections of it in both of their work, that a thousand flowers, theories bloom, and Kuhn's very title, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Of course, scientific revolution has its own quite different history, but it was, he was living in a liminal space before and after a huge shift. And my dissertation, the guy I focused on in my dissertation was also, this was Willard Van Orman Quine, who I wrote on a dissertation on Quine's epistemology. And at that point, nobody thought he had an epistemology. He was treated as a logician and maybe even a metaphysician. But Quine was clearly trying to pull out of positivism, unsuccessfully, in my view. But he was one of the transitional figures who became important for other thinkers down the road. So yes, it was. I still find Kuhn's work very energizing.
I don't know if you've listened out here or there, but there's this new book by Errol Morris, who's a student of Kuhn's, and it's called the Ashtray.
Oh, really?
They had argument and Kuhn threw an ashtray at Errol Morris. And this is the
I remember reading a review of this somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the book yet, but I'd be curious to see what his angle on. Because it is very much like Errol Morris is really one of kind of capturing the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
And who's just, he digs into the zeitgeist and
kind of I met Popper once at a some kind of philosophy conference, and my recollection is it was in Canada. And I mean, those philosophy meetings were fiery in those days. I mean, whoa! I mean, we haven't seen that kind of excitement in a long time. There was just real anxiety. I mean, in some ways, I'll come to talk about it later, those issues of the 60s haven't gone away. They're as, who was it? Brazilian anthropologist, Eduardo, what's his first name? Viveiros de Castro said, Kuhn and Feyerabend couldn't have imagined what different worlds we'd be talking about today at that moment in history. But those issues of working across worlds have only gotten more intense.
Mm-hmm.
And with a kind of same kind of large political consequences that haven't been seen since the 60s in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's another form of anti-authoritarianism is the way I think about it.
Yeah.
Of course it goes too far here and there, they always do, but they're important moments.
There's also a similar informatic critique from someone like Marshall McLuhan then.
Yes.
And we've got, you know, the sort of Felder bubble. And
right.
The information sharing is going on now. It's very much we're living.
Yes.
There,
I'm going to take a cough.
Yeah, go for it. Do you
have
a good tea?
Pardon?
You've got a good tea here.
Yep.
And so we'll do number two now.
Mm-hmm.
So how have you found STS has altered your disciplinary training?
As I indicated, you know, I think I've managed to do some of this already. Sorry about that. As I mentioned already, disciplinary training. Okay, I'm sorry. Forgive me.
And you feel free to repeat yourself.
Excuse me, I'm just going to take a minute to look here. I renumbered these and forgot that I renumbered them. Yeah, I did some of this already. Yeah, I sure did. Sorry about that.
That's okay. No, feel free to repeat yourself because it's really
okay.
Like per question, whatever the answer
okay.
is.
Okay. So this is about having always had a social science appointment. Shall I do it again?
Yeah, or maybe if you maybe have an example of a riddle or something you were dealing with and how you're able to tackle it by having social science input or this view to how science gets done.
Mm-hmm. So pick up some stuff from later, that's all right. Okay, so ask the question again.
Sure. How has STS altered your disciplinary training?
Well, from the beginning, I was a rogue philosopher. I've always been involved with both teaching in social science contexts, having joint appointments to sociology departments, or as in the case of recently, last couple of decades, of the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA, the whole department is social scientists of education, plus two of us philosophers. And also in my own work, I've worked through, especially standpoint theory was developed by, of course, originally Marxists, but got radically revised by us feminists beginning in the very late 60s, early 70s we began. And I was a philosopher, but the others were mostly sociologists, such as Dorothy Smith and Patricia Hill Collins later, and Nancy Hartsock, who was a political theorist, and Hilary Rose, the British sociologist of science. So both in my scholarly work and in my institutional work, I've always been working with social scientists. And one, just to give you one example of how that kind of, I think of it as a borderlands position. I never give up my philosophic training, people tell me, even though that narrow, analytic, positivist influenced training I think is incredibly narrow, even though it's still immensely popular in many departments in the US and elsewhere. And I'm never fully in the social sciences either, face it, I've never systematically collected data the way social scientists do. But on the other hand, the social theory part of the social sciences has always been important to my work. And recently, it's become especially important because one of the practical, very practical projects that I think STS is good, is important for, is to contribute resources for science and technology policy. That is to do a kind of educational project for policymakers who hear complaints. Let me give you an example. Just before the Beijing conference on the Year of Women, whenever that was, back in the 90s, maybe 90s sometime, I ended up being recruited by a number of UN organizations to help them organize how to present their women science and technology issues. They had many, many decades of complaints from women back to the League of Nations, they tracked them, about how unfairly women and women's issues were treated in the sciences. But they had no way to organize it that made a compelling argument of the sort that they wanted to make. And then appeared standpoint theory and strong objectivity, which was the part of it I worked on. And they loved it because it gave them a way to insert their, not to be a side issue of complainers, but to insert their work positively on scientific grounds into science policy. And so I worked with various UNESCO meetings. As a matter of fact, the first time I met Ebi Vasuri, who I know was on your list of people to interview, was in Paris 3 or 4 decades ago, and was one of those meetings, not directly focused on feminism, but there were several feminists there. It was some UNESCO group that was preparing for Beijing. And I met with UNIFEM, which is the, I forget exactly what that how you work that acronym out, but it's a very old organization. It had existed under the League of Nations and was collecting all these complaints and disorders. This proved a wonderful opportunity to show the importance of STS for policy. And that was a couple decades ago, preparing for Beijing. I've been asked to get involved other times since then, but rarely have, because there are plenty of other people who can do it now. But somebody who's is a perfect example of how important this work has become, Londa Schiebinger, who's a well-known historian of science, of French science in the 17th and 18th century, as I recollect. Heads an institute at Stanford. She has a whole listserv that tracks, and she must have a team of a lot of graduate students, because they track what's happening in public institutions all over Europe and the US, and they're just beginning to reach out to the rest of the world. And I get mailings maybe every 2 weeks and they list three new science and technology programs in Belgium, France, and the Netherlands that have now inserted into their requirements for applications that they explain the relevance of this work for gender inequalities. What effect is it going to have on it? And so she has, you can get, one can get the backlist. It's just an incredible project. And while it's a bunch of separate data pieces that she's collecting, they're tied together by this larger understanding now that science and technology are in society. And consequently, society is inside science and technology, whether it likes it or not, it's there. I think that's been, in terms of how disciplinary, my borderlands disciplinary position has turned into a kind of more general policy position that's working back and forth between philosophy and the social sciences, theories about science and scientific practices. One of my good friends at UCLA is a well-known 4S person, Sharon Traube, anthropologist and historian of science institutions. And she and I knew each other, have known each other for a long time, but we both arrived at UCLA, I think the same year. And we went to each other's events. I went to her events in the history department, lectures and so forth. And she went to mine in philosophy and wherever I was going to them. She's here at these meetings. And she finally said to me one day, she said, "Sandra, now I understand you for the first time, what you do. You plant yourself on the edge of an institution and you refuse to go away." And I think that's true because I'm located at UCLA in a graduate school of education. Most of my friends in the arts and sciences think that's an inferior place to be. I think it's highly superior. It's interdisciplinary. It's a very well-established one, highest rank in the U.S., and it has as its mission improving education, and science and technology education are a lot of that, as well as the research methods for their own work. So I think what looks like a strange liminal position at one moment is the harbinger of some kind of, frequently can be the harbinger of a more general shift in institutions. After all, the departments that most colleges have now were established in the late 19th century. And there's no reason why those departments should be the only ones relevant. And administrations, if you look around, go to a lot of effort to try to bring breaths of fresh air into their colleges, which they find difficult to do in those older departments. So they're very happy to establish these cross-disciplinary groups because those are ones that can bring in. That's certainly the case at UCLA.
Yeah, it strikes me that between both your example of Vonda's work and the working the capacity of educating the educators here, mm-hmm. it's dissemination. It's disseminating information
in
a very systematic way,
codified way,
as opposed to the sort of, for lack of a better term, ivory tower idea of pinnacles of knowledge that it could be a beacon of light if you so choose it, but you're going to choose that.
Exactly. Exactly.
Fantastic.
I'm going to take a cough.
Yeah. Shall we move on to four? Discuss four S.
Let me just tell you, I only have two little things to say about it.
Okay.
I would rather. How much more time do we have?
We have as much time as you need.
I'd rather take more time to talk about the other practical application.
Okay, I would like you to discuss
which would be journals.
4S.
Oh, okay.
If it's not a significant role in your part of your career, that's fine.
Just say a little something.
Sure.
So
yeah, if you could,
they're very obvious things to say, but
sure. Yeah, if you just tell us the story of your first meeting.
remember them, first meeting. But anyway,
sure.
We'll give it a try.
And how you feel like the field has changed since that?
Yes.
That
okay. So I can't even remember my first STS meeting, 4S meeting, but I think there were probably about 150 people there, maybe. So the first obvious change is STS, 4S has gotten huge. How many people are here? Is it 2,000? I think it's around, it's something around that. I mean, if you look at that humongous program and look at the huge breadth of topics and approaches being covered, and look at all the stuff going on the side, and especially all the efforts this year to make STS honestly international, instead of simply claiming an internationalism that really is not grounded in reality. So I would say the increase in sheer numbers has been accompanied by an increase in areas of work, and one obvious one is that at the beginning, my recollection is there weren't that many policy people. It was mostly maybe not even historians. The historians have tended to keep their distance from 4S. I think that's unfortunate, but that happens. But it was mostly sociologists and anthropologists. It wasn't people hanging around the edges of Washington, D.C., but there are a lot of them now. And they frequently don't share the background of STS work in particular. So it makes, I think, very interesting exchanges and constant self-education, so to speak, going on through the 4S meetings. I always love to look at the program and see, wow, I had no idea they could bring STS perspectives to bear on that. That's great. So for me, it's the one conference I try never to miss. Some of these foreign ones are too much travel for me, but I managed it this time, and I'll be glad to go to New Orleans when it's back in the U.S. again.
Do you feel like the policy orientation, does that exist solely, or is 4S a nexus for that, or is policy also finding its way into STS and departments and journals and the other kind of spaces that STS doesn't exist?
Well, the journals I've been involved with, it's definitely, I've been heavily involved with, it's definitely getting in there, and that would be, I edited Signs, SIGNS, I have to spell it so people don't think I'm saying science. Signs, Journal of Women in Culture and Society, which was not the first big international women's studies journal, but it was the biggest and best established. I think its first volume was 1976, University of Chicago Press. By the time I edited it, which was from 2000 to 2005, it had an 8% acceptance rate, and you could, if there was going to be one feminist journal that some institution was displaying on their coffee table in the waiting room, it would be Signs. And so I ran into it in the Romanian Ministry of Technology and Railroads or something like that, and you know, there it would be. And there were definitely policy issues about gender and science were important in that, but more so as the years went on, I would say. For the last 2 years, I've been involved I'm on the editorial team for a brand new journal that's brilliant. It's called Tapuia, Latin American Science, Technology, and Society. It's in English, though all the editorial decisions are made south of the Rio Bravo, the Rio Grande. They're all made in Latin America. The rest of the editorial team is a group of brilliant young Latin Americans. A number of them are here. They're on the editorial team now. They're from Brazil, from Argentina, from Mexico, from Colombia. And of course, science and technology in society for the peripheral countries, if I can put it that way, that have not been strongly represented in, let's say, 4S, is always a matter of policy, because they've had to suffer the consequences of development, modernization theory that has science and technology at its basis. They've had to suffer the misperceptions and mistreatment of their own science and technology systems, which have been very powerful and frequently are very old, but virtually unknown, or treated as merely myths and superstitions by the North. And so for this journal, policy issues are very important. They're not the only ones, but they're important. I don't know what to say about the role of, I'm not close enough to big graduate programs in science and technology studies in the U.S. to say much about them, but the people I know are interested in policy.
Mm-hmm. It does seem like both the truly transnational spirit of this year's 4S, mm-hmm. journals like Toyota, that they don't enjoy the privilege of duality, right? They're forced to confront these mm-hmm. issues in very practical ways, like mm-hmm. talking about, right? So mm-hmm. policy doesn't become let's include some policy papers. Mm-hmm. Generally, it becomes policy is what is irrelevant. Maybe it could become a qualifier of what would make a suitable article to include or a topic to address because it's got impact. In that sense, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're agricultural policy, they're medical policies, they're internet communication policies. You know, all of these are affected by the resources they can get from various places, but including the places the North gets them, like the United Nations, UNESCO, and various other agencies, and what the World Bank and IMF think about what they're doing. And so there are a lot of very interesting studies going on about how not only, so to speak, the bad guys from the North, the openly colonial extractive practices of Northern corporations and so forth, but also a lot of us good guys, a lot of us progressives, have nevertheless failed to actually understand how science and technology works in Latin America and how the journal is committed to turning Latin Americans into subjects of scientific knowledge rather than suffering the historical position of being the objects of other people's knowledge and extractive policies, using them as data, using Latin America as data. So I think things are changing, and the way policy issues figure in outside the North and in subjugated communities in the North are becoming much more understood by the centers of power in the North. So that's a good thing. Can't happen fast enough, and it is always blocked by the vested interests in those still present colonial practices of extractive. They don't want to Northern corporations don't want to share the profits with the poor. Right? They're highly invested in keeping a whole bunch of poor people around, whether it's working in their mines or agricultural fields or in service industries in Los Angeles or wherever. So it's the usual interesting political situation. But again, I think this is a particular historical moment when issues about the role of science in society are on the front page of the LA Times every day because of the politics of distruth that have become not only a scandal in the US, but in many other countries too. So it's a particular moment when global forces that we can't control, but in which modern Western sciences and technologies have played a big role, for better and for worse. At least there's a lot of communication now between the internet and cell phones and so forth. But this, change is happening, and Forest needs to, as it is doing hugely at this conference, reach out to incorporate those issues into the ongoing thinking of 4S people, because we're pretty powerful educators. We know how to do it. And a lot of us are doing it in different ways. I'm happy to work with a journal that's published in English, but presenting the Latin American perspective on the kinds of issues that ST and HV hasn't until recently begun to pick up on. So we hope to be a resource, the journal will be a resource for STS in the North, but also for science and technology policy anywhere.
Fantastic. I feel like we've already previewed question number 5, but just to kind of recapitulate this in terms of practical applications.
Okay, I'm going to stop for 1 second and cough.
I don't know if you have a particular way that you want to rehash this conversation in terms of...
I thought I'd maybe talk about Tapuia's structure, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's very innovative. And I've got a page on it somewhere. Where the heck is it? There we go. Excuse me for a second. Let me eyeball it and remind myself what I thought I was doing. Yep, I pretty much said it, but we'll try it again. Yeah, I'll recapitulate it and step in whenever you want to.
Sure. Yeah, it gives me more to work with on editing. Trying to get this on the fly. So I'll ask you a question.
Okay.
What do you think has been the most important practical application of STS?
I think that there have been two kinds that seem extremely important to me. One is public education, and I'll say something about that. And the other is working within the kinds of institutional resources we know how to work with in a second way, namely journals. Which can reach big audiences larger than we perhaps have in mind. So first, public education. We are educators. We know how to do that. And it has been very interesting to me that STS is beginning to develop undergraduate programs. There aren't a lot of them, but there are a couple of them, maybe more than that, already starting. And certainly undergraduate courses are starting up. And I think that's an excellent place to bring the insights that STS offers. After all, we have literary criticism that helps us understand how to read poetry, plays, novels. We have art criticism that helps us understand how to look at Picasso's Guernica or Rembrandt and understand it in society and in its own terms. But it's only STS that begins to do that for science and technology. They've always been left outside that legitimate interpretive framework. Historically, it's only scientists who have been legitimated to tell the story of science, after all. Professional history of science is not that old, right? It was usually the aged, wonderful old scientists reflecting on. There's a couple of volumes out there that pick that up, and they're very amusing and very lovely in a certain way, but they feel far away. They feel like something that is not done in literature or any other field. And I think this is a particularly important moment to take on that problem, project of public education, because issues about what counts as truth and what counts as mere opinion, which are central to science thinking and SDS thinking, are on the front page of the Los Angeles Times every day and everywhere else around the world too. So I think SDS and 4S in particular have an especially rich set of resources to contribute to these discussions. So public education, I think, is one very important place for it. A second one, as I mentioned, is journals, the disciplinary journals, which have not usually been thought of as public education. They've been thought of as communication between us scholars. And that's, of course, extremely valuable. But they can also be resources for public education. And I'm now involved in helping to get founded a wonderful new journal called Tapuia, Latin American Science, Technology, and Society. And it's published in English, but all the editorial decisions are made in Latin America. I don't make editorial decisions. I got it incorporated in the U.S. I got it a bank account in the U.S., which the publisher in England and all of the South American editors insisted the bank account could not be in Latin America because the political situation makes that very vulnerable. So it has a Bank of America account in Los Angeles. But all the editorial decisions are made in the South. It is electronic only. It is open access, which is terrific because people who can't afford subscriptions, and of course the whole publishing industry is a riotous chaos these days as libraries and individuals try to figure out how to deal with the costs of publication. But for Tapuia, for it to be available anywhere in Latin America where that you can get on the computer is great. It's open access, is free to those who want to read it, but authors pay to publish, which is a pattern that got established in the natural sciences. However, in the case of this journal, the fees are very low, and they're waived for anybody who does not have paid research. So I think they're $300 is the top, but that's waived by anybody who needs it waived. So the journal is indeed available for public education, and it's already attracted a wonderful set of articles. We're about halfway into volume one, and one can go online and read them. And when we get a full volume one, we will start approaching other institutions, particularly the Latin American Studies Association. We're now affiliated with 4S. It shows it right on the literature. I don't know if you can see it here, but here's the 4S symbol. And also SOCTE, which I could bungle the Spanish, but it's the equivalent in Spanish in Latin America. But we want to approach also the Latin American Studies Association, which for the most part exists only in the U.S. In Latin America, they don't have Latin American Studies. There's a little of it, and there certainly are some programs elsewhere in Japan and Norway and so forth. I have to take a cough. I'm going to swallow a cough drop while I'm at it. Yes. Latin American Studies, if you check out your local university program, rarely has anything on science and technology. It tends to be entirely literature and history, which is, you know, wonderful. There's not even very much in the social sciences, occasionally an anthropology course, but not a lot. And so we want them to know that they can now offer science courses on their campuses, because Tapuia will be providing a steady supply of first-rate articles on science, technology, and society, the equivalent of 4 issues a year of a regular journal. In year one, we'll probably only have 20 full articles plus a bunch of book reviews, but we hope to move up to 30, or maybe even, if we get really smart and lucky, 40 very quickly. So there'll be plenty of articles on topics about science and technology in societies, plural, the different ways they function in different parts of the world. This makes possible kinds of courses that weren't possible before. And we hope that will have an effect, as the educational project does, on new generations coming up, that they will be able to understand the importance of STS for their lives. So I hope 4S has 10,000 people attending it, and that Tapuia is one of the journals and projects that's made it possible for many of those people attending to be coming from other parts of the world than the former British Empire and Europe.
I'm struck by your point about sort of siloed nature of Latin American studies, that the idea that the development of STS is almost as like a strain of cultural studies,
mm-hmm.
where we have American studies, we've got Latin American studies, AFAM, and that STS was almost another kind of cultural study.
Yes.
That didn't ever harmonize with these other cultural contexts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're suggesting, or the point is that, you know, there's a particular Latin inflection
mm-hmm.
on STS that matters. And
mm-hmm.
you can't just take the two parts and smash them together.
No.
That you need to understand. And in many ways, the recognition that STS has been a very northern, very western
yeah.
kind of construction hasn't acknowledged the other kinds of constructions that have happened outside of that quadrant.
That's right, and it's also young. I mean, STS is relatively young, and we've needed to be talking to each other so we knew what we could be saying to larger audiences. And so I think the very fact that STS is so expanded itself, that it's made itself important for policy, for example, and now has this huge outreach to other parts of the world. I mean, Tapuia is not the only such journal from other parts of the world. The East Asian Science and Technology Studies is out there, and there are a few others. There's an Italian one and so forth that are developing, and there are going to be more. We're already talking with some people in China. There's some wonderful Colombian graduate student who got his doctorate in the very best STS program in China, knows all the top people there. They're thinking about starting a journal in mainland China. And he in Colombia is going back and forth between 4S and the Chinese people. And there's already a 4S, is it a 4S? An STS listserv for Africa. And I know there's talk within 4S of trying to get a conference in Africa sometime soon. Meanwhile, I believe, you might have to cut this if it turns out to have been a wrong thing to say, but I believe that in 2022 there'll be a joint meeting in Puebla, Mexico, between 4S and SOCITE. So 4S has really been moving on this, and that's important.
Mm-hmm. Great. Have you covered everything that you wanted to cover? Is there anything you wanted to add? Or ask you my curveball final question?
I don't think so. I think I've gone over everything twice by now. I'll take the curveball.
Okay. So interpret as you will. Do you know any STS jokes?
Oh, do I know any STS jokes? Oh, isn't that a good question? And why don't I? Are we too serious?
I don't think we are. I think there's lots of humor in what we do, and I think, you know, just even the tradition about the methodology, right, which is built in the ironic and humorous. I feel like there's something there, and I want to know what STS people find funny, and if they know any jokes.
I really don't know. You know, it's interesting because I think STS, unlike some other disciplines, we're always a little self-critical because we have to position ourselves always with people from every side saying, "What, you're doing that? How dare you do that?" From every side. So I think we get used to kind of maneuvering our positions. I mean, I'm sure this isn't true of everybody and so forth, but it's not, I mean, we're a new field that's intruding into the social, there are sociology of science courses, of course, in many departments, but not as widely as there could be. And ethnographies of science and technology, you know, obviously histories have been there, but I think we're still in the earnest stage. And I'm going to have to think about that now. I don't know any jokes. And that's sad.
That's okay.
Have you heard any?
No, mostly reactions similar to that. But again, you know, we're also talking, this series of interviews are very sort of generational. You know, you've been talking about the Dark Ages. Dark Ages are very funny times, right? And like you're saying, the sort of politeness,
mm-hmm.
pushing in someone else's space.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, maybe if I ask that question to a recent generation of STS scholars, they might point to examples from the work we've been reading. Like, you know.
I'm sure they can make fun of us oldies. So there's a start.
Absolutely. But that's a fantastic answer. So the final thing I'd ask you for is, as a, you know, these are really thumbnail histories.
Yes.
So I'd like to give you a chance to, you know, if we gave you a byline, Sandra Harding, what would your byline read other than your UCLA affiliation or your standpoint theory? What would be a way you would like to be introduced to the world?
I don't know if I'd like to be introduced in the world this way, but it certainly is something I can keep in my mind, and that's Sharon Trawick's statement that I plant myself on the borders of institutions and refuse to go away. And I find that a very fun place to be. I mean, I have to be very careful not to recommend it to graduate students because they say, "Oh, I want to do what you did." I said, "I don't know about that." You have to start out somewhere else, I think. It was kind of an accident of history that I got drawn, that I went rogue right coming out of philosophy into the social sciences, and without any training in social sciences, more in political philosophy and social theory.
It also took someone else to point that out too, right? It wasn't deliberate strategy to be in calcitrant.
No, it wasn't. But
it's in your nature.
It's in my nature.
You're a stubborn individual.
I am. I'm stubborn and I'm loud,
right.
But I'm polite.
Right.
So. Turns out to be a great combination as far as I'm concerned.
Great word for you, man.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I think we're good.
Okay. Well, thank you for the interview.
Of course.
Thanks. It was great.